It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Oliver Simmons is with us today. He was a member of Kentucky's national championship team of 1996. He was named Tennessee's Mr. Basketball in 1994 and 1995 while playing at David Lipscomb High School in Nashville, and then was recruited to UK by Coach Rick Pitino. Early in his sophomore season, he transferred to Florida State, where he played for 3 years and started for a total of 47 games for Coach Steve Robinson, about 2.5 seasons altogether. And Oliver's had a long career in teaching and coaching. He and his family live in Stuartville, Minnesota, but he keeps up with the Wildcats and has some great memories of his time at UK. So, Oliver, very good to have you with us. Thanks for doing this today.
Keith, thanks for having me on. I'm excited.
Tell me about, let's catch up with you currently now. You're teaching and coaching there in Stuartville. Tell us about what you're doing.
I am. So I teach high school business classes, and I help out with the boys and girls program. So I was a head basketball coach at the high school level for 20 years. And when we moved to Minnesota, I tried to step away from coaching, but it seems like the varsity coaches always pull me back in to help with their programs as much as I can. So,
and you're still enjoying it and having fun with it, I guess, right?
I love it. I love basketball. It's been a part of my life for as long as I can remember, and don't see that changing anytime soon.
Well, we're recording on March 17th, so obviously we're in the middle of March Madness now as we're getting ready now, having had the selection show and getting ready to start the tournament. Tell me your views on this current UK team. They've had some ups and downs this season. Some injuries have affected things, but how do you see them as they go into tournament play?
I love this team. I love what Coach has done to the program. Obviously, with the injuries, it's really hard to know what we have. Which is a shame, because throughout the year I was super excited with their style of play. So many amazing wins, but night in and night out, you just never knew who we were going to have. I do feel good about our draw. I like our bracket, so I do think we should see some good things coming up Friday and Sunday.
Well, certainly there's a lot of excitement here as the has begun, and your former teammate, it's hard to imagine really how things could have gone better as far as the off-the-court connection with the fans and reestablishing that and getting started and building a team in 3 weeks or so. It hardly could have gone better, could it?
Absolutely. He's amazing when it comes to that. He's such a people person, and you just gravitated to him whenever you're around him. So I knew there'd be no issue with that. And as you know, Keith, Kentucky fans are Kentucky fans. They're hard on every game. Every loss is devastating, and every win is a triumph. So he had his ups and downs. But if you take a step back and really look at what he did this year, it's been a great season, a great first season for sure.
And it seems like his former teammates, knowing him then and knowing the kind of person and player that he was, it seems like none of them is surprised that he's having this kind of success in his coaching career, even leading up to Kentucky and now here.
Such a hard worker from the moment I met him. Such a smart guy, being a Rhodes Scholar in college, deciding to be a doctor, then changed his mind. I followed Coach Pope most of his coaching career. I've stolen a lot of his offensive tendencies and things like that. So I've been studying him a long time, even before he got to Kentucky. So me and along with my other teammates, we knew he was going to do a great job.
Well, your former coach, Rick Pitino, is not only still active as a coach, but really is one of the star personalities of this tournament and has a team in St. John's that could contend for a Final Four spot. Here he is 30 years later now and still at the top of his game, it seems.
You know, after I transferred, so many people for the last 30 years have wanted to know, you know, what my thoughts were on Coach Pitino. And I started the same way every time. He's the greatest basketball mind of anyone I've ever met. He is the greatest basketball mind of anyone I ever met. So I don't expect anything else from him when he comes to coaching the team.
What makes him so special and able to accomplish things and motivate people and then strategize during the game? What brings all that together, do you think?
You know, there's probably so many factors into it, but the one thing is just how much he puts into it, how much I can remember when him and I were having conversations before I transferred, when he was kind of trying to help mold me. He just doesn't sleep much. He pours everything into, he's, you know, and you've come across people like that. There's some people in this world that need 8+ hours a night, and there's some people that only need 4 or 5, and he's that 4 or 5 guy where he just, he lays his head down, he gets his rest, and he's right back to work. He just puts so much into it. But on the other flip side, he pulls so much out of you and demands so much out of you that you're just ready to play. I can remember when I transferred to Florida State, I had broken my foot and been out. I've been out for about 6 to 8 weeks in a boot. And my first practice at Florida State, I can remember the rest of the guys just being exhausted and me thinking, you would never have survived a Patino practice. Like, if you're tired from that, I haven't done anything in 6 to 8 weeks, and I'm not tired. So it's just how he runs his programs, how he designs his practices, and how he just pushes you to do so much.
Do you remember your first meeting with him as a prospect in high school?
I honestly don't, because I started getting recruited at a really young age, and living in Nashville, I was so close to Lexington. He started, you know, my sophomore year, and I started going to games over and over again. I mean, obviously there was always a bit of a, not an awe, but a bit of a, like, you know, wow factor with him. He grabs your personality. He's, you know, gets all the attention in the room, that kind of thing. But, you know, he's changed a lot since my time at Kentucky, for sure. He's had to. The times have changed, so.
Yeah, the times really have changed, and even a Rick Pitino, in fact, maybe especially a Rick Pitino, is able to adapt and change and be the kind of coach that is going to be successful in 2025, just like he was in 1995, as far as results are concerned, but still a different way of displaying the coaching personality and the motivation and all of that. And when you go back to your time, you got to UK, you see your teammates, and of course you've, I guess, gotten to know each other, at least heard about each other, and of course some of the guys were from your area too, but what were your impressions as you got there as a freshman and then began to actually step in and be immersed in this stuff?
So I was just, you know, enthralled by it. When I grew up, I actually lived in Lexington. A lot of people forget this. I lived in Lexington from when I was 5 years old to 10 years old. So I fell in love with Kentucky basketball back with the Twin Towers. And so I always dreamed about playing there. So once I got recruited, it was a pretty cut and dry situation for me. And my experiences at Kentucky were amazing. Honestly, the hardest part was my relationship with Pitino and how we just clashed. I was a 19-year-old that didn't feel like I needed to be treated that way in order to get the best out of me, and he felt like that's the way he treated everybody. And so it was a little bit difficult at that time, but as far as Kentucky itself, it was amazing. All my experiences there, through basketball, through school, everything was just great.
Yeah, and what a truly unforgettable year, too. A great team that is now ranked among the best ever in college basketball. And so, yeah, I want to get into that a little bit, too. But you talked about your differences with Pitino, and you can look back on it now, 30 years later, and see it in a different light, of course. But at 19, you got to make decisions based on what you know at the time and what you feel is happening at the time. And John Calipari used to say the Kentucky program is not for everybody. I guess Rick Pitino is not for everybody either. No matter how much respect you might have for him, you still have to deal with him on a day-to-day basis. So that had to be a bit of a struggle, getting to play for Kentucky, which was your dream, and getting to play on a great team, but at the same time having some issues with the coach.
For sure. And when I look back, I think if I didn't break my foot, I probably wouldn't have transferred. But it was the broken foot and the being pulled away from basketball because of the broken foot. I think that made it harder on me. I think, like, he was just as hard on me my first year, but there were at least games. There were things that were getting my mind off of it. There were chances for me to compete. When I broke my foot, those were all kind of taken away. And then I just kind of focused on the way he was treating me in our relationship. And so I don't blame that, but I think that was the driving factor to make me actually transfer. Mm-hmm. And it was just, again, like, looking back, if I could do it over again, obviously I wouldn't. For many reasons. The biggest reason was I transferred in January and he left in April to go to the Celtics. So
right.
one way or another, I was going to be done with him anyway. So That's one factor when I look back. But the second factor is I never had any basketball people in my corner. So my parents didn't play sports. They weren't athletes. My high school coach, his coaching philosophy and the relationship philosophy could not have been any more drastically different than Patino's. So when I called home, I didn't have anybody to tell me, like, this is normal, he's pushing you, those kind of things. And so it was hard in that factor as well. So
I think all of your former teammates would have stories about how hard the practices were and how they were treated individually too. But you know, you get to another school, and Florida State's an ACC school, a Division I program with some history of success too, and you see the difference in the practices. But give us a little perspective on what made Patino's practices and just playing for him such a challenge and so tough on everybody, even though you're accomplishing a great deal as well.
So it's super organized. He demands everything. Everything is timed. Everything's a competition. All your mistakes are recorded. You're going to run for those. Like, everything is just high pressure. And then on top of that, the competition was so great inside of the practices that, you know, everybody was competing so hard. And that's what I remember the most. I tell people, for me, I wasn't competing for a starting spot, but I would watch Mark Pope and Walter Moriarty go at each other to see who was going to be the starting center. I would see, you know, Anthony Epps and Wayne Turner and even Tony Delk at the point guard competing. Like, it was so much talent day in and day out at every drill that you had to bring it. You couldn't take a day off or someone was going to steal your time. And I think that helped us in the long run become so deep and so good.
Mm-hmm. And what about just the sheer physical challenge of it? How did he challenge you physically? Sometimes when you hear the players tell a story, you think, how could you go through that every day? But what are some examples of how he would push to where it's beyond the limits that you think you have?
So the things I can remember is some of our conditioning tests. So we had to do a down back. So we had to run the other baseline and back, and then the other baseline and back again. We had to do it in 22 seconds, and then we had to rest for 22 seconds, and we had to do 22 of them. So you had to make 22 of them in 22 seconds with a 22-second rest. And I can remember, you know, some of us younger guys, like Nazi and I, falling at the end of the runs or barely making it. And then, like, the seniors, Walter and Pope and Delk, just cruising across that line. Like, you could see that they had been used to it. Mm-hmm. And that I can remember that. And then practices, like, we had a full court 3-point shooting drill that we had to make X number in 4 minutes. So we're sprinting and shooting threes. And I mean, just everything was so difficult. And then the whole part about, like, keeping score in practice, I can remember you either had a positive score or a negative score, and it was based off of turnovers, assists, rebounds, made shots, missed shots. And I can remember every day having a negative score. So I was running every day at the end of practice, even though I was like the 10th guy on the team and barely got into scrimmages. So I can remember having those conversations with him when I was, you know, having a hard time, saying, like, how am I running 30 line drills at the end of practice when I only scrimmage for 2 minutes. Like, so those kind of things just, and you talk about the stories, we all have stories, but it's funny when we get together, Cameron Mills and I, we like to go back and forth and compare who he was harder on. And this, my last visit to Lexington, I think I might've convinced him that Patino was a little harder on me. So,
yeah, I know he was pretty tough on Cameron too. He tells those stories. Of course, now we hear him on the radio a lot here, and he will relate his experiences. And you were looking at it really from the same perspective, in the sense that you were maybe not competing for starting position, but certainly trying to compete for as much as you could. And it was such a loaded team too. And you watch those guys go at it every day. I wonder about guy.
Before you move on to the next point, I'm going to jump back on what I said earlier. So Cameron's dad, being a UK player, mm-hmm. when he went home to complain, his dad was able to tell him the benefits of staying, the benefits of pushing through, and why coach is doing that. Well, my dad wasn't a sports guy, and all he wanted to do was, you know, call Patino or come up there or protect his son. So I think that was a factor in making it harder for me when I didn't have somebody in the corner that was there to tell me that this is how it goes.
Yeah, that's a good point, too, because it is such a tough experience for a young kid at that time. And even though you've been in basketball all your life, there are times you're going to need to talk to somebody other than the coach or maybe even an assistant coach who can give you that perspective. So, yeah, because at 18 or 19, we really don't have much perspective on our own, do we?
We don't. We're so young.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the idea of, I guess you have to redefine what a good day is when you're in that position, because if you're going up against some of those guys that were veterans on that 95-96 team, it's going to be pretty hard to have a good day on the basketball court. How did you try to get yourself through and have what you might define as a good day when, even though you might not come out on top in working against some of these more established players?
Just seeing the improvement. I can remember starting individual workouts and, you know, it rotated who it would be, but it would always be someone similar to your playing day. So sometimes it would be me and Pope and McCarty, or it'd be me and Antoine and Nazi, or me and Jared and, you know, someone else. So I just seeing the improvement of how, when we first started, when we got on campus in September compared to the middle of the season, or I can remember, like, you know, doing well in a scrimmage. Or the funniest story I find about this, and I've never had anybody find the records, but I know it's true. Our first blue and white scrimmage, I led the whole team in scoring, not because I was the best player, but Walter hurt his ankle, and so I got twice as many minutes as everybody else. But that's my bragging point, is saying, hey, I was on the team with 10 NBA players, but I led in scoring in our first blue and white scrimmage. So those are good days that I remember. But it, like I said, it wasn't all bad. It was small, bad moments when Patino would kick me out of practice or put me on the treadmill or scream at me or put me down. Or, you know, coaching style was so different back then compared to what it is now. It wasn't the screaming. It wasn't the cussing. It was the putting down. It was the being mean, but in his words, trying to break me so he could rebuild me. Those were the hard times for me. But the majority of the time, I had a good time. I competed. I got after it. So it wasn't like I was overwhelmed in whatsoever as far as the basketball. It was more of the Patino and I.
Mm-hmm. The depth of that team was incredible and allowed for the team to adopt that pressing style and not worry about foul trouble and things like that. But but it also allowed for the creation of a junior varsity team, which was, right, I guess, pretty close to unique at that time and even now. Tell me about that and how you fit in there.
It was a crazy experience, to be honest with you. So it was funny because I was actually dying as far as my time when the JV thing started. So me, Nazi, and Cameron and Jason Lathern played on the JV. But Coach Patino didn't realize back then there was a 20-hour rule for the week. You could only do 20 hours. Well, he had me practicing with his squad and practicing with JV squad, or I'd practice with his squad and then have a JV game that night. And finally, after about a month, Sandy Bell came down from compliance. He's like, Oliver can't do both, Coach. Like, he has to still be under the 20-hour rule. So I can remember being in the lodge, like, resting because I had JV practice that night and varsity practice was going on. And one of the managers banging on my door saying, hurry up and get over there. Antoine just got hurt. Coach needs another big. And just things like that. So just my schedule was crazy wild. There was a couple weeks where I didn't practice with the JV at all because I needed to be at his practice, but I'd play in their games. So it really wasn't a great experience. I averaged a double-double in JV. It was a lot like high school. It was much easier, but it was never enough for Patino. He was constantly pulling Nazi and I in the meetings and going over how we weren't playing well enough. We were both averaging double-doubles. So it wasn't a great experience. At least it was some playing time. We had fun in the games, but as far as the rest of the experience, it wasn't great. And I think that's why it doesn't work, because you can't have scholarship players do both. You just can't.
Is there a story illustrating Patino's methods that maybe you can laugh about now that you couldn't then, that might also illustrate what kind of coach he was in practice?
I mean, it was all his stories are about as bad as for me. But the one I crack up the most on is we practice in Memorial, and he would turn off. He still does this. I saw a video of him at St. John's, but the lights weren't off. He would turn the lights off in the stands, and he would go way up in the bleachers with a microphone. And then he would yell at us over the microphone, and you would turn to look at him, because a sign of respect when he's yelling, you need to be looking at him or else he's going to get more mad, but you can't find him. You don't know where he is in the bleachers as he's yelling at you over the microphone system. So that one, I remember blowing me away. Like, I don't know where you're at, coach. I don't know where to look. I'm getting screamed at. Like, so yeah. But I did see a video of him. He goes up in the stands at St. John's and does the same thing.
It's 30 years later, that one still works, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Or at least in his mind, it does.
Right.
We're recording on March 17th here, and I want to ask you about getting into tournament time. But let me ask you, in looking back on that 96 season, as you go through the season, I'm sure it didn't take long to realize that, hey, this is going to be a really special team. But as you roll through that season and most of the time just rolling past teams and putting them down early and not letting off the gas, what was that stage like as you watched this team perform and were part of it and you're just piling up all these victories?
I mean, as the season grew, we started to realize that we had something special. You know, we went undefeated in SEC play. And as bad as my stories are about Patino, there are tons of good things. Like I said, he's the greatest basketball mind I've ever been around. There's tons that I've taken from him into my own coaching. Him and I have spoken many times, and we are great now, not an issue now. But my biggest memory of when I knew things were going to really take off is we lost the SEC championship game. And if you can imagine from all the Patino stories, we're in the locker room in Louisiana, and we think we're about to just get just our butts chewed. Like, we thought for sure. I to go back even further, I remember coming up from Nashville being recruited, and they were beating, I can't remember who it was. I want to say Arkansas or somebody. We were beating by 30, and we ended up only winning by like 8. And I'm up there as a recruit in the locker room. I've already committed. And Patino comes in and he writes on the board, 12:01 a.m. And he walks out and the assistants are like, we're practicing at 12 at Memorial. Be ready. Because the 20-hour rule had to be the next day.
Right.
So they practiced at midnight. So to go back to the SEC championship game, we thought we were going to get chewed on. We thought we were going to get off the plane and practice. And he came in, and his message was short and simple. He's like, we needed that loss. We're about to win 6 in a row and win the national championship. You guys go out and have fun tonight. And that was, like, we were like, yep, that's what we're going to do. Like, we totally bought in at that. That speech, we went out, had fun that night, and the rest is history.
Yeah, the rest is history, but you must have been stunned at that moment anyway, that's what he said.
So stunned. So stunned. I thought for sure we were going to find a gym somewhere to practice or something. So well, everybody was shocked. Yeah, but it flipped the locker room quickly because we were all super upset. We thought we had, you know, something bad had happened. We thought we messed up, and he flipped the script, and it was great.
The national championship, we still see highlights of the game against Syracuse, and the games as you get down into the Final Four especially become real battles, even for the most powerful teams. What do you recall about that championship game and the celebration that followed?
I just remember Patino's game plan and took a jump in the tournament. You know, we played Tim Duncan. We played the two bigs from Utah. Like, we had a lot of serious NBA talent that we ran through to get to that, and nothing was different than championship. In the Syracuse game, his game plan was perfect. The players played amazing. I remember the end, it was kind of a blur at the end, but Anthony Epps ran over right in front of the bench to our crowd and was cheering and turned, and him and I hugged, and we just started celebrating. It was just an incredible feeling, finally, that season, to everything to come to what we had hoped it would happen. And Still think of those memories today, for sure.
Yeah, that's there's a spontaneity, of course, to the celebration, as always. But at the same time, if you take even a second to reflect on it, you think, well, all that work and all those practices, everything came through for us, as he said it would, and here you are as national champions. I mean, I know you, at that time you just want to celebrate the win that night, but as you have further time to reflect on it, it really, really does show all that work paid off.
For sure. Like he has the blueprint to be successful, and not all teams end up that way for him, but like we did, and we put the sweat, blood, and tears in. And that's the thing people don't understand is everyone did. Like, I didn't play very many minutes, but I was a big part of getting those guys prepared. We were on scout team. We were learning other teams' plays. We were pushing them in practice. And I played in every game in the tournament up until the Final Four. Like, just to look back and think that we did that as a group. And one of the reasons why we were able to do that was obviously the coaching staff and our talent. But off the court, we were super close. Like, I can remember that from day one, getting up there. We were hanging out together from that point on. It's like all of a sudden you have 15 best friends, and we would do everything together. And that's – it shows today still with our group chats and us getting together. And as soon as we hit Lexington or wherever it is that we land, we're right back at it. We're cracking jokes. We're having good times. We're telling stories. We're teammates for life, and that's part of the reason why.
Yeah, especially on a championship team, I would think those relationships are going to tend to last, and
they
certainly have. And you've had some events here where you get a chance to see your former teammates, as well as some players from other periods of time at UK as well. And that all everybody says that just means a tremendous amount to them as life goes on. And it seems like it's certainly been that way for you, even with the relatively short time here at UK.
For sure. I said this my last visit when they did a whole bunch of interviews. I had a great time at Florida State. I had great teammates, had great coaches, really enjoyed my time, and I kind of consider myself an alumni of both. But it doesn't compare to that 96 teams, the tightness that we are, the brotherhood that we are. It just doesn't compare. Like I said, I'm close with some guys from Florida State, but at Kentucky, it's every guy. It's just kind of what I consider home whenever I go back there. It's like it feels natural to be there, and the fans and the community, everybody's so supportive of us and loves us. And even Calipari was great to us when we would go back, and obviously Pope is amazing to us as well. So it's a great to still be able to have that and do it, and I love Kentucky and always will.
I wanted to ask you about your time at Florida State. You played for Steve Robinson there, and you started some 47 games over the time that you were there. So you were a key part of the team as far as being on the floor during the games, and did well there. What are your thoughts there about the time? You certainly got additional playing time with the move.
For sure. It definitely worked out as far as playing time. I always tell people my experiences were two different experiences. Kentucky was a basketball experience, meaning when I went to Kentucky, everything revolved around basketball. I was more of a basketball player than I was a college student. At Florida State, I got more of a college experience. When the season ended, I was more of a college student. You know, I didn't get the attention in town. I wasn't noticed everywhere I went like it was in Lexington. So I got to be more of a college kid, but still being a Division I athlete. I had great experiences there. We had fun games, played in Cameron, played at UNC. You know, the ACC was definitely different, got to see other teams. So it was a good experience. I enjoyed it.
And you moved on to have a long career in education and coaching. Was that something that you had thought even at that time that that's what you would do, or stay involved in the game in some capacity? Was that already in your mind even as you were finishing up at Florida State?
So as I was playing at Florida State, I thought maybe that I'd be interested in coaching. I got my master's in sports administration. So that was another positive. When I got the transfer, the rules back then, you had to sit out a year. So I got an extra year of school paid for. So I went and got my master's. I got it in sports administration. I thought I'd be a college coach or maybe work in an athletic department. Then after I graduated, I played professional basketball for 3 years in Europe. So when I got back from that, I really had no idea what I was going to do. And was working out at Lamar University down in Beaumont, Texas, trying to get in shape to go play again. And the coach there was like, "You ever thought about coaching high school?" I go, "Honestly, never." he got me in touch with a guy down the street, interviewed for the coaching job. I didn't realize that I had to teach to coach high school. I thought I was just applying to be the high school coach, and they think, no, you have to teach. So then that started, and the whole cycle from there, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
As you coach these young people now, their memories, I'm sure, come back of your time at UK. Does anybody, if you have to deal with a complaint from a parent or something about how practices are too hard, can you keep a straight face? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I definitely tried to steer towards my high school coaching style, the way he was with his players, than Patino did. Just like anywhere, there's complaints and there's positives. But it's like I said, I steer much more towards where my high school coach was than Patino.
I always like to ask the guys who have played internationally what it meant to them. Tell me about your international experience in professional basketball and what that meant to you.
So it was a dream come true. Obviously, as a young kid, you always dream that you'll get paid to play the sport that you love. So that was number one. Number two, I thoroughly enjoyed living in a different culture and seeing how different parts of the world lived. So I had a really good time, especially in Sweden. I played in Sweden first. That was a tremendous experience. I played in Des Moines, Iowa, actually next, in the International Basketball League. It was kind of like the G League level. I really enjoyed that as well. It was very different than college ball. We took buses everywhere. But again, getting paid to play basketball was my full-time job. That was pretty awesome. And then I finished up in Holland, but I ended up getting injured my last couple months there. So it was kind of ended on a sour note. But like I said, living in a different culture, having that experience, the stories coming back from it, tremendous, tremendous time.
Yeah, that's a real opportunity that I would think is maybe kind of hard for a young person to really latch on to. What a great opportunity it is, in addition to getting paid for playing basketball, but you get a chance to live in a different country, as you said, a different culture. If you have your eyes and ears open, it can really be a great learning experience in addition to doing the basketball thing. And I would think that there are many examples of how that was brought home to you. What do you recall, anything particular experience in Sweden or Holland that really brought that out?
So my favorite story to tell is when I was dealing with my agent, I told him I need to play in a country that speaks English. Learning another language has always been a challenge for me. Mm-hmm. And so we picked Sweden. Everyone speaks English. They learn it from a young age. Everything is good. So we get there. The general manager, the coaching staff, everybody's great. Well, around town in the restaurants and everywhere that I was supposed to go, because what they do is they pay you to play, they pay for your living, and they provide you with a car, and they provide you with meals at certain restaurants. Well, no one would speak to me. They were kind of rude. They didn't speak English to me. So my first 2 weeks was really hard. And I can remember calling my agent going, this is crazy. Like, I thought we made sure that they spoke English. And when I went to the general manager, he just kind of laughed and said, everybody speaks English, you'll be fine. And so about the second 2.5 weeks in, we had an exhibition game. And I think I had like 25 points and 10 rebounds. And the next morning, it's the same restaurant I go to every morning for breakfast, same waitress. She's speaking English to me. So I said, why haven't you spoken to me in 2 weeks? And she said, we were just waiting to find out if you were any good or not.
Yeah, had to make the cut, I guess, before they...
Right. So that's kind of one of the stories that sticks out. And then from then on, it was, like I said, Sweden was tremendous. I had a great, great experience there.
Tell me about your tournament watching habits as we all get ready to settle in for a month of or 3 weeks of great basketball. How do you like to watch the tournament? Are you in front of the TV constantly? Do you just keep up casually? How will you watch?
So as you know, the last couple of years have been a little difficult. So don't want to bring that up too much, but it's been a little difficult.
Hasn't been 3 weeks of basketball during that.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing. Like, it's hard to do brackets when your heart is Kentucky Blue and you pick them to win it all, and you're really not believing that they can. So that's been difficult. But as a teacher, I used to, early on in my career, I used to take the Thursday and Friday off and not teach those days and watch the tournament. As I've gotten older and have my own kids, I got to save those sick days for sick kids. So now I put it on my computer or put it on the TV in the classroom and try to watch as much as I can. I like the old days when, you know, the CBS would flip to the end of the latest game. So I'm a big, like, last 4 minutes of each game, I'll flip to that game. I won't watch the whole game. I like to wait till they start, you know, lining up to where they end. That's why the first weekend's the best, because there's so many games. As the tournament goes on, they don't start the next game until one's over, so it gets hard to do that. But I really don't watch that much basketball anymore as much as I used to. I watch Kentucky play, and that's pretty about it. So,
well, we all have fun, especially with this first weekend of the NCAA tournament coming up as we record here on March 17th. Oliver, one final question for you. Any message that you would have to the UK fans who followed you during your days here and continue to follow the team through the years?
Well, I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for always treating me so good. Even after I transferred and came back, I can remember when Calipari first invited me back the first time back. I was so nervous, but they were so great to me. And then as far as the team now and Pope, just continue to believe. We're not going to win a national championship every year, but day in and day out, he's going to put a product on the floor that we can be proud of. And hopefully he's around for a really long time and continues our winning traditions. So thank you.
All right. And thank you, Oliver, for doing this. We appreciate your time, and thanks for coming on with us.
Anytime, Keith. You know I love the Big Blue Nation, so I'd be happy to be back anytime.
You've been listening to the WUKY Sports Page with your host, Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced at the WUKY studios by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to the Sports Page through iTunes, Google Play, or at our website, wuky.org.